Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced he is suspending Britain's parliament from mid-September to mid-October. The UK is scheduled to leave the European Union on October 31st, which leaves very little time for debate. And then we will discuss the devastating fires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. We'll talk about how the media are covering the indigenous people fighting for their land. We will also talk about JBS, that is a Brazilian meat company that slaughters a staggering 13 million animals every day. We'll talk about how the global beef trade is destroying the Amazon. Today we're joined by Eric Regilli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail based in Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us. We're also
a pleasure.
Great to have you back, Eric. And we're joined in studio by Chris Feliciano Arnold, a freelance journalist and author of the book The Third Bank of the River: Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Eric, I want to start off and talk about what's happening with Brexit. This is getting international news. There are a lot of stories out about Boris Johnson's decision to shut down Parliament from mid-September to mid-October, and the UK is scheduled to leave the European Union on October 31st, which leaves very little time for debate. Can you bring us up to date? What is the latest on this? Jeremy Corbyn said the Labour Party this Tuesday is going to try to stop this.
Well, Rose, the latest is it looks like it's going ahead. The Labour Party and the opposition parties who oppose a no-deal Brexit have not come up with a plan that's going to work. They tried going to the courts, and a court decision today in Scotland ruled in favor of Boris Johnson. So that looks like it's going ahead. Now, there's nothing illegal about suspending Parliament. It's done all the time. It's just almost never done in history for 5 weeks, and it's clearly being done to suspend any, to kill any debate on Brexit and whether or not they can get a deal. So in that sense, it's considered undemocratic. And also, Boris Johnson, you got to remember, is unelected. I mean, he's an elected MP, but he was not elected as premier, and he has a minority government. So you have an unelected premier in a minority government clearly making an undemocratic decision to suspend Parliament. I mean, it's a complete mess, and it's triggered a lot of anger.
How is he able to pull this off so quickly?
Well, first of all, Rose, he said he was going to do it. I mean, when he replaced Theresa May on July 24th, a bit more than a month ago, the first thing he said is Brexit is coming, do or die, exact words. And also, it's a technicality. He himself didn't suspend Parliament. He went to the Queen. Queen Elizabeth got legal advice, and she was the one who suspended Parliament. It's called proroguing. It's actually happened to Canada, where I'm from, once or twice, but not for 5 weeks. You can do it for a few days, but not this long. So it looks like he's on legal firm ground. It's just that he out and out lied about it. Now, I know Boris. I used to work in London in the 1990s at the Times of London. He was at the Telegraph. So I have a sense of how he operates. We co-hosted a conference a few years ago in London, and this time he just out and out lied. He said this is the proroguing of Parliament, suspension of Parliament, had nothing to do with Brexit. It had to do with giving his government time to get a new agenda for the autumn. It was just a lie.
How are the people responding to this, Eric? There have been a number of protests. Some of the signs say stop the coup, and huge rallies are planned for this Saturday at noon outside 10 Downing Street.
There will be huge rallies, but it's, I don't know if it'll be enough. There probably is going to be huge rallies in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Remember that neither Scotland nor Northern Ireland voted for Brexit. England and Wales did. So, but I don't see the more protests that that it happened, the more Boris Johnson's getting his backup. And so I just don't see it working. I think that it's going to go ahead. The only question is whether, now that the European Union knows that Britain is absolutely leaving on October 31st, whether they will do a deal with Britain to allow it to trade after October 31st. But that's not certain. Remember, the EU's got a lot more power than Britain does.
So what would a no-deal Brexit actually look like?
Well, there's all sorts of scare stories that were dismissed as Project Fear by no less than Boris Johnson himself a few years ago when the referendum was held in 2016. And Project Fear said that Britain would face an economic calamity. Well, it hasn't so far. But one of the reasons it hasn't is that I think it didn't. Most Britons didn't realize that did not accept that it was actually coming, because you remember it kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed, and the Remainers, as they're called, just assumed that it was just going to get kicked down the road again and forgotten about it. Well, now it's happening, and there's a lot of small and medium-sized companies that are not prepared. I think the bigger companies are prepared. They have emergency plans. But you we're hearing horror stories about medicine shortages, auto parts shortages. You know, Britain's a big automaker. Food shortages. There is going to be a border between the EU and Britain. And if those trucks are backed up for hours, let alone days, there's going to be shortages in Britain. I think it will happen.
Wow. How will this affect the economy in the near term, Eric?
Well, I wrote about that today, Rose. Britain may already be in recession. In the second quarter, the GDP growth was marginally negative. And that was before Boris Johnson was even premier. I think there's a very, I'm going out on a bit of a limb here because we don't have the latest data, but I do believe that Britain is already in recession. Germany may be in recession already. Italy may be in recession already. The global economy is slowing down. So, I mean, think of it this way. The global economy is slowing down for Britain just at the very worst time for Brexit, because you have a slowdown globally on top of a Brexit, which could be devastating if it wrecks the supply lines, if the European Union puts up tariffs, if the borders are closed, if the trucks line up. It's going to be a huge negative.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story, Eric, and we'd love to have you back in the coming weeks just to find out what's happening. I want to ask you about the G7 summit. You were there. You reported on what happened there in France, and specifically about the Amazon fires that continue to rage. French President Emmanuel Macron announced a $22 million aid package. Can you talk about what went on behind the scenes? How did the world's most powerful countries come up with a $22 million number?
Well, listen, I don't know if the number's real. I mean, I was there. I've covered a lot of these G7s and G20s, and at the very end, the leaders go into panics about putting out a positive press release. There was no positive press release that will come out of this, because Trump basically says no to everything, as he did. He was a bit more polite at this G7 than he was in the last two. At least he didn't storm out. But still, there was very little progress. So French President Emmanuel Macron went around and said, can you make some sort of commitment for the Amazon? And he got 20 million. But 15 of that million, by the way, was from Canada. And the number's probably bigger than 20 million. It might be $30 or $40 million. But who cares? I mean, it's nothing. Mm. I mean, Canada last year was the host of the G7. And in the year of preparation for that event, it spent hundreds of millions of dollars getting that event set up. So what is $20 or $30 million going to do? I mean, it's absolutely nothing. What is that, about one day's profit for Amazon or Facebook, or even, a few hours' profit,
yeah.
It's not enough to tackle this problem.
Right. Chris, what was your response when you read coverage from the G7 around the Amazon fires?
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree that the 22 million, whether it's 22 million, 40 million, 50 million, it's relative to the scale of the problem, woefully inadequate. And I was also struck by just how quickly it spun off into sort of an interpersonal spat between the French president and the Brazilian president and whether the money was going to be accepted and under what conditions and so forth. And for me, the larger question is the Brazilian rainforest needs all the international support it can get, but to what end and how will these resources be used? And if these $22 million or $50 million are only going to be used for occasional seasonal military firefighting efforts or so forth, then what's that going to do to resolve the structural and systemic issues in the long term? And that is a question that I think went unanswered largely because of people's rush to do something in terms of a positive press release coming out of the G7.
Eric, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would largely agree. And then the other issue is what we haven't talked about is that so far Bolsonaro has said he's not going to take the money. Canada's also offered water bombers, and he hasn't said he will take them because it's Bolsonaro and Macron are insulting each other. They're both accusing each other of being rude. So it's turned into a personal grudge match. I have no idea whether Bolsonaro, who's accused Europe of quote colonialism, is going to take the money or not. But my point is, so what if he does take the money? It's a drop in the ocean.
Hmm. And Eric, what explains Macron's tweet? He said, quote, "Our house is burning literally. The Amazon rainforest, the lungs which produce 20% of our planet's oxygen, is on fire. It's an international crisis. Members of the G7, let's discuss this emergency first order in 2 days, exclamation point." What would you say is behind that tweet and that reaction? Is he concerned about the environmental damage there, or does this have to do with politics?
To his credit, I actually think he is concerned about the Amazon burning down. And the 20% figure is more or less accurate. He's been pushing an environmental agenda since he became president in 2017, I believe it was. And in the days leading up to the G7, I mean, the Amazon was not even in the agenda in the weeks leading up to the G7. And, in the few days before the G7, the global media was just flooded with stories about the burning Amazon. And I think he had to react. And he did. So I wouldn't be too cynical about that at all. I think it was legitimate concern.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, to his credit, I think it to make it an agenda issue was important and a reflection of current events. In addition, France does have a greater stake in the Amazon than many other G7 leaders on account of French Guiana. They consider themselves an Amazon country insofar as they have territory in the Amazon region. I think with regards to Bolsonaro's reaction to those offers of international assistance, that digs into some longer-term historical and political context in Brazil, insofar as Brazilians across the political spectrum have take great pride in the Amazon and have a long-standing suspicion of international interference in the Amazon, particularly Brazilians on the right and Brazilians with the military background of Jair Bolsonaro. Have for decades thought of the Amazon as a very strategically important region and borders that must be defended against foreign espionage and to a certain extent that reaches into paranoia. But I do believe that Brazilians are right to defend their sovereignty over the Amazon rainforest that they have in their territory. And yet in the wake of these fires, we saw international pundits and policymakers calling for green helmets to go into Brazil, for example, and put out the fires, or using words like rogue state to describe Brazil, or ecocide to describe what's happening there. I think that's a bit of an overreach, and I can understand why it puts all Brazilians in sort of a defensive posture, especially when we look across the developed world and see so many other countries taking environmental actions. We don't have to look far here in the United States, for example, to see environmental actions that are doing great harm to the global climate. So while I do believe that it's important for international leaders to step up and put pressure on Brazil, I also think we need to consider what's happening in the Amazon in its global context in terms of climate and environmental policy.
And Eric, before we let you go, I'm wondering how meat production is being covered in the European press. Later in the show, actually in just a couple minutes, we're going to talk about this two-part investigation from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, The Guardian, and Reporter Brazil. And they've got this really amazing piece, a couple pieces. One is called JBS, The Brazilian Butchers Who Took Over the World. Another is called How the Global Beef Trade is Destroying the Amazon. And a couple of days ago, the EU Observer had a piece about how the EU is, according to the, EU ought to consider banning Brazilian beef unless it takes action on forest fires, Finland, the holder of the EU presidency, has said. Can you talk about how this piece of it is being covered in the EU?
Well, yeah, I think the Guardian and its sister paper, The Observer, have been banging on for years, and they're right about how our heavily meat-based diets are creating huge damage to the Amazon and other forested areas. I mean, Chris would know this better than me. I've not actually been to Brazil, but I live in this UN environment, a Rome food environment, and the clearing of the Amazon is not to grow food so much for people, but to grow food for cattle. So it's doubly bad in that sense. So it's starting to dawn on people now that that one way to spare destruction of the rainforest is to eat less meat. And you see what's happening on the stock exchange in the United States. Some of the hot new companies like Beyond Meat are making vegetable products that taste like meat, like taste like real hamburgers, and they're very, very hot at the moment. So we're just starting here on this curve, but we've got a long way to go.
Well, Eric, as always, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That is Eric Reguli. He is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail based in Rome. And you can find his reports at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Chris Feliciano Arnold, a freelance journalist and author of a very important book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. And if you want more detail about that book, we had Chris on last year, I think it was, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. So, Chris, we're going to dive in and talk about beef and what is happening in the Amazon. But before we do that, let's step back for a minute here. You wrote an entire book about the Amazon, and you paint a portrait of the Amazon by tracing its history from the arrival of the first Spanish flotilla to the drones that are now mapping unexplored parts of the forest to indigenous tribes. Given the level of attention that these fires are getting, what, just in terms of the context that we need to understand this and the Amazon, what would you say is missing from the coverage, and what do we need to know more about?
Yeah, I think one thing that's important for us all to consider is the deep historical context in which all of this is playing out. So on one hand, since the earliest days of settler colonialism in South America, the Amazon has been seen as a couple different things. First of all, this sort of verdant Eden, this fertile, untouched land, this paradisical South American forest, and at the same time, this El Dorado that is home to all of these potential mineral riches and other things that can be exploited for colonial gain. And so I think what we're seeing play out centuries later is a sort of tug of war between those two visions of the Amazon. So on one hand, we see global environmentalists and those on the left rightfully in outcry over the potential devastation of a truly unique and irreplaceable biome in the world. And on the right, we see capitalists and conservatives in outcry over the roadblocks that have been thrown up in the way of what they see as a resource that needs to be developed for economic purposes and a place where we could potentially extract very valuable minerals, timber, and so forth. And yet both of the sides of this argument have fundamentally misunderstood some important things about the Amazon, which is that for environmentalists, while they're absolutely right that the Amazon needs to be protected, it's also home to 30 million people these days. So across the wider Amazon basin, there are more people than live in the state of New York, more people than live in the state of Texas or the state of Florida. There are more people who live in the Amazon basin than in Finland, Norway, Switzerland, and Sweden combined. They may be spread out across a great geographical region, but that doesn't mean they don't deserve access to sanitation, healthcare, education, transportation, and all of the things that we would consider important to leading a high quality of life and reaching their full potential. On the other hand, for those who would rather dive into the Amazon and exploit it for its mineral riches, they're taking an approach that is fundamentally at odds with the true riches of the Amazon, which is its incredible biodiversity, which has even now in 2019 barely been tapped into by scientists, by researchers, by those who could tap into the biodiversity and the indigenous knowledge in the region to open up whole new worlds of possibility from that beautiful rainforest. And so while it is very exciting for those of us who watch Brazil and who watch the Amazon to see a return of attention to this region, it's also a bit distressing to see how people on all sides of this discussion have sort of clung to these outdated sensibilities about the region.
What other updated versions would you like to see if what you're saying is a lot of it is outdated?
Yeah, so when you hear, if you were to listen to Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro describe the Amazon region, he uses some truly reprehensible and downright racist language to describe the region and the people who live there. Fundamentally, the way that he describes the Amazon is unpatriotic, racist, and just ahistorical. And one of the things that you'll often hear him talk about is you know, how the Amazon region is essentially like this backwater. He's described the indigenous Brazilians who live there as, in his words, cavemen. He's described them just this week. He said that, quote, they don't even speak our language, and yet they now have 14% of our land. So in addition to just being fundamentally factually inaccurate, it's also at odds with the fact that the Amazon rainforest is actually quite developed in 2019. There are thousands of miles of roads in the Amazon. There are dozens of ports that move enormous amounts of soybeans, of cattle, of timber, and other resources. There are oil and natural gas pipelines. There are cities of millions of people, full of tech companies, manufacturers, universities, research centers. There are Brazilians in the Amazon who are indigenous. There are also Brazilians from all over the country in the Amazon, in addition to Haitian immigrants, Chinese immigrants, and immigrants from across the world. And so I think it's so important for those who speak of development in the Amazon to recognize the degree to which it's already been developed. It's just unfortunately been developed very unwisely.
Today we're speaking with Chris Feliciano Arnold, freelance journalist and author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. Chris, when were you last in Brazil?
Yeah, so the last time I was in Brazil was last fall during the lead up to the election to Jair Bolsonaro, and I was there for his election. I was also in the Amazon region last spring covering the exodus of Venezuelan migrants to the Brazilian Amazon as that crisis has expanded over the course of the last several years. The flood of migrants has not only gone to Colombia, but now increasingly to Brazil and to the Brazilian Amazon. And while I was on the road in the state of Roraima last spring, Bolsonaro happened to be passing through town in the city of Boa Vista, sort of explaining his economic agenda for the state of Roraima and for the Amazon, and sort of pounding the table on this development agenda that he has for the Amazon. And yet, then and now, his development agenda for the Amazon region is fundamentally at odds with reality. And if you were to look at, even though he's only been office now for 9 months, if you were to look at the state of the Brazilian economy, it's certainly no better than it was a year ago, and in many ways worse.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And after the break, we'll continue talking about the Amazon, providing more context. We'll talk about indigenous peoples who are fighting for their land. And then we will also talk about the global beef trade. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you'd like to listen to our past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can find information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about media coverage of the devastating fires in the Amazon. We're speaking with Chris Feliciano Arnold, freelance journalist and author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. And he was there last spring. And I'm so glad we have about 30 more minutes with Chris, just to bring in a lot more information and more context. And so if you have any questions, comments about the coverage you've been seeing, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Chris, any more context you'd like to provide? Because, you know, we hear things like, you know, Brazil holding one third of the world's remaining rainforests, including a majority of the Amazon rainforest. You also hear about it being, you know, the lungs of the earth, being so biodiverse, and we'll talk about that later. But I think what you brought up earlier about how people are still living in that past vision of the Amazon rainforest is so important. What else do we need to know about how things have changed there over the past few decades?
Yeah, I think one, if we were to focus, for example, just on the indigenous experience in Brazil, one thing that I think is important for people to get their minds around is that even within the lived experience of indigenous Brazilians, there's a huge range of experiences. So just to give you a couple different examples, there are within Brazil's borders more than 100 isolated tribes who are living in some of the most remote regions of the planet, in societies and in ways of life that are very similar to the ways that their ancestors were living in the earliest days of settler colonialism. Now, these tribes aren't uncontacted per se. They've actually had contact with the modern world, but it's been very dangerous contact, which has caused them to retreat ever further into the rainforest. These are the indigenous groups that often get the most global attention, because periodically a tribe is spotted and it becomes a sort of global spectacle, and rightfully so, because these are groups that deserve our attention and protection. At the same time, across Brazil, there are settled tribes in the Amazon, for example, who live in much closer proximity to roads, much closer proximity to cities and towns, who are living lives that are in many ways very close to the land, and in living in ways that are very symbiotic with the rainforest, and yet who have routine access to the contemporary world through radio, through television, and who aspire to educate their children and send their children to universities to become lawyers, to become doctors, and potentially bring that knowledge back to the community. And further still, there are many urbanized indigenous Brazilians who are living in cities in the Amazon, who are living lives indistinguishable from the lives that you or I might live here in the Bay Area. And so I think it's exciting to see so much coverage of indigenous Brazilians. It's exciting to see them organize as they have to amplify their voices and tell their stories in their own voices. At the same time, I do hope that people take the time to dig in beyond the headlines or beyond the snapshots and learn more about the true dynamic nature of the indigenous experience in Brazil. Because even to describe them as indigenous Brazilians sets them apart in a way that I think people in Brazil and across the world need to understand. They're Brazilians. They're every bit as Brazilian as Jair Bolsonaro. They deserve the same rights. They deserve the same freedoms. They deserve the same respect as any other Brazilian. And so even as we respect and appreciate their differences, we also need to be careful not to set them apart and otherize them in a way that only feeds into these misconceptions that people have had about indigenous groups throughout history.
Right. And so can you talk a little bit about the indigenous groups that it's interesting, because a lot of the – and we live in a different media world now. And so you've got AJ Plus, Now This, showing videos of indigenous peoples fighting for their land. BuzzFeed sent a reporter to the Amazon, Tatiana Farah. The piece is, "This indigenous tribe in the Amazon survived forced labor and epidemics. Now their land is on fire." Time. I mean, across the board, there are now pieces about indigenous people in the Amazon. What are your thoughts about the coverage overall?
Yeah, it's incredible. So first of all, I want to be cautious not to be so so analytical of the coverage so as to devalue it. I mean, I think in this historical moment, any coverage that centers the indigenous experience and amplifies indigenous voices is valuable. I think one of the most exciting things is how social media, in particular WhatsApp, Facebook, and so forth, have allowed indigenous communities to tell their stories in their own voices and to reach the outside media at unprecedented speed. So just a few weeks ago, as an example, in an indigenous community in Amapá, an indigenous leader was allegedly stabbed and killed by a group of invading miners. Within a matter of just a couple of days, Caetano Veloso, in concert in Mexico City, was talking about that incident on stage to his audience. That's the speed at which these stories can travel now. Whereas as recently as the 1990s, a crime like that may have gone unreported for days, weeks, if not months, if it had ever been reported at all. So the speed at which the indigenous communities have been able to organize themselves and tell their stories and has just been astonishing. And the savviness with which they are able to tell their stories is also really inspiring. I think what the next step of this coverage looks like is for reporters, both in all mediums, to take the effort to spend more time in those communities, to not just do what you might call parachute journalism, but to actually engage, return to the communities at different times of the year, and for lack of a better word, embed with those communities long enough to get a sense of the true day-to-day lived experience.
The AP also has a good story. Brazilian indigenous people speak out as Amazon fires rage, and a number of people were quoted in this story. So far, in 2019, Brazil reported 83,000 fires, a 77% increase from the same period last year. Many of those were set in already deforested areas by people clearing land for cultivation or pasture. With over 98% of Brazil's indigenous lands within the Amazon, the threat to groups are particularly exposed.
I'm so glad you called out that story, because if it's the same one that I'm referencing or remembering from a couple days ago, there's a brilliant quote in there from a Kayapo leader who describes, if I'm quoting him correctly, one of the things he says is, this president, referring to Jair Bolsonaro, says, this president doesn't know the Constitution very well. And for me, what I love about his voice in that piece is that it's the perfect example that these indigenous communities are actually quite engaged in the political process. They have voice at the local, regional, and at times state and federal level. And they know their rights as enshrined in the 1988 Constitution in Brazil. And so, contrary to what some people may believe, that they're living in the rainforest unbeknownst to them and surrounded by this nation of Brazil, they're actually quite engaged in the process. They know their rights. They know their borders. They, in some cases in Brazil, indigenous groups have gone out of their way to demarcate their own borders and take matters into their own hands. And so I thought that was a great story, and I love to see this sort of cascade of coverage now that is putting indigenous voices and experiences front and center.
Yes, so important. That's why we wanted to start off by talking about indigenous people and to give some more context to that. So let's talk about these fires and why there are so many more this year. Again, 83,000 fires just this year. So Jair Bolsonaro has been blamed for the dramatic increase because he has been encouraging ranchers and loggers to clear these areas and, quote, develop the Amazon. So let's talk about that piece of it.
Yeah, I think when we think about the magnitude of these fires, it's been truly astonishing the extent to which they have captured the global attention over the past couple weeks. I think one way to look at this is in the context of what's new and what's the same.
Yes.
So let's start with what's the same. It is a dry season in the Amazon rainforest, and every dry season, farmers on the agricultural frontier of the rainforest engage in slash and burn agriculture, essentially clearing land, at times a great deal of land, for the next year's planting, for the next year's grazing, and so forth. These fires are part of the way of life there in Brazil, and they, if we look at this year's fires in particular, the numbers of fires are way up. But if we look at a longer-term average, say, over the last 10 or 20 years, they're higher, but not as radically higher as they are in the last year. Which begs the question, why are they up so much this year? And that brings us to what's new. What's new is that for the past year, and even when Bolsonaro was on the campaign trail, as I said last spring, I was on his campaign trail in Roraima, Jair Bolsonaro has been talking about this pro-development agenda in the Amazon with this anti-indigenous, pro-agricultural rhetoric that has emboldened farmers, large and small, to essentially engage in unbridled land grabbing in a region where land rights are already very fragile and environmental protections are already very fragile. With that in mind, Bolsonaro and his administration haven't had to engage in a ton of formal legislative policy change to do great harm. They've defunded many environmental protection agencies. They have also just simply refused to call on some of the environmental agencies that they could rely on to fight fires, to prevent mining and deforestation, and so forth. We were talking earlier about WhatsApp. Much like indigenous groups can use these technologies to organize, small farmers can also do the same. And so on August 9th, we saw small farmers in the Amazon frontier organize what they called a day of fire to show Bolsonaro how willing they were to work and how ready they were to get to work. And so created this organized burning that started the initial wave and cascade of fires, contributed to it. The other thing that's new, however, is that just a couple weeks ago, one reason why these fires began to get global attention is that the skies above Sao Paulo went dark a few hours early, and it suddenly struck Brazilians in the southern cities, who are usually happily oblivious to what's going on in the Amazon, to suddenly realize, wait, this is starting to have a very serious and deleterious effect on our life here in the south and in the cities as well. Mm. So that sort of combination of what's old and what's new, I think, helps explain why suddenly these fires have been everywhere in the media.
What has the policy of previous governments been when it comes to clearing out the forest to make room for cattle and soybean production?
Yeah, so what the policy of previous governments, if we look back, say, at the earliest years of the Workers' Party administration, Lula's administration, which was very progressive in its efforts, and in many respects very progressive in its efforts to combat deforestation, was that, in essence, a farmer could clear 20% of his or her – or excuse me, that a farmer needed to keep a certain portion of their land intact and they were allowed to clear an additional ratio of land. And they also, during the Lula administration, were very eager to create and to adequately fund environmental protection agencies that could go out and monitor those lands to make sure that not only that they weren't being clear cut, but that there wasn't illegal mining operations, illegal timber operations, and so forth. Likewise, during the Lula administration, we saw the emergence of stronger and better organized indigenous services. So indigenous protection agencies, indigenous health and education were given great attention. Now, I don't want to pin all of these changes on Bolsonaro, because the damage we're seeing didn't happen overnight. Beginning in 2012, President Dilma enacted some very substantial changes to Brazil's forest code, which allowed for a much more lenient approach to clearing land and so forth. In addition, during the Lula's years, we did see some environmental projects, some green development projects like the Belo Monte Hydroelectric Dam in Altamira that, for all their good intentions, caused tremendous economic or environmental and social harm in the Amazon. And so by no means was the Workers' Party flawless in its environmental stewardship, but what we've seen in the Bolsonaro administration and the campaign leading up to his administration is a very aggressive change in tone and a very aggressive rollback of some of those already fragile protections.
You mentioned farmers, the small and large farmers. This is a question I have had for a couple of weeks now, reading the pieces about the global beef trade. Who are these farmers? Are we talking multinationals coming in? Are we talking family farms and then large? Can you just explain that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways of looking at farming in the Amazon as well, too. So on the one hand, when we think about some of these smaller slash and burn fires that we see on the frontier, these are oftentimes subsistence farmers who are living in plots of land and doing their best year by year, season by season, to clear land to graze cattle or chickens or plant and essentially feed their families and perhaps make some profit for the year ahead. It's incredibly difficult work. Slashing and burning a rainforest is dangerous. It's dirty. It's not pleasant. And these farmers are very much trying to do their best to survive and to feed their families.
So these people live off the land, mm-hmm. and they feed their families mm-hmm. based on what they raise and grow.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they don't always have the most sophisticated or nuanced agricultural practices. And so they may not be taking care of the soil in such a way that allows them to cultivate and maintain the same plot of land year after year, season after season, which forces them to sort of go deeper and deeper into the frontier and slash and burn to find new land rather than continuing to grow and maintain on their existing plots of land. In addition, really fragile land ownership and land rights makes it difficult for people to feel secure right. that this is my plot of land. I can stay here this year. I can stay here next year. This will be my children's and my grandchildren's land. So that plays into that as well. Then we have the JBSs of the world on the other side of the spectrum, which are enormous industrial-scale agricultural entities who can clear forest, sadly, far faster than environmentalists can raise consciousness about what's happening.
Today, we are speaking about media coverage of the horrific fires in the Amazon rainforest with Chris Feliciano Arnold. He is author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. He was last there reporting in spring, and he's also a freelance journalist. So let's now talk about JBS and this global beef trade. And I just want to give kudos to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. They worked with The Guardian and another organization out of Brazil. And I'll find that name in just a minute. I want to give them credit.
And while you're giving credit to the journalists of Brazil, I just
Reporter
want to call out
Brazil.
That just as the media here in the United States have been under relentless attack by the Trump administration, Brazilian journalists have been increasingly called fake news, which is a term that's gained currency in Brazil. They've been threatened. Their livelihoods have been threatened. Many times individual journalists have been called out by President Bolsonaro on Twitter. So on the off chance that any Brazilian journalists are listening to this program, they ought to know that they're doing absolutely vital work in their democracy right now, regardless of what the government may be saying about their work.
Yes, thank you. And we hope to get them on a future show. So just to give a little context before we talk about JBS, deforestation is the main cause of the fires in the Amazon. Cattle ranchers are named as the single biggest driver of deforestation, causing about 80% of it. This is according to Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. So I just want to read the lead from this piece called JBS, the Brazilian butchers who took over the world. If you eat meat, you probably buy products made by one Brazilian company, a company with such power it can openly admit to having bribed more than 1,000 politicians and continue to grow despite scandal after scandal. JBS, a Brazilian company, slaughters a staggering 13 million animals every day. So hard to believe, one company, and has annual revenue of $50 billion. So let's talk about JBS. We did a show about 2 months ago just about how the global beef trade is just adding so much to greenhouse gas emissions, and JBS was on the list, and yet I'm guessing a lot of people have never heard of this company.
Yeah, I think it's insofar as a lot of people don't give much thought about the source of the meat that they consume aside from its journey from the supermarket to their plate. But JBS is an enormous player in the global meat market. And when we think about that market in the context of the Amazon rainforest, it is land that is fundamentally just not that amenable to cattle grazing. And The sort of agriculture that firms like JBS engage in is exceedingly hard on the land and requires a absolute ton of natural resources in order to sustain not only their markets, but as we know, publicly traded companies like that thrive on growth and demand growth. And so through any means, whether it's additional clear cutting or use of questionable whether it's pesticides or herbicides or other sorts of other sorts of dangerous chemicals, large agricultural firms like this have every reason to take whatever measures they can take in Brazil through whether it's through bribery or illegal activity to further their land use and further their growth.
And this company is run by two younger brothers, Wesley and Josely Batista. And what else do we need to know about this company? According to this piece, they have been linked to allegations of high-level corruption, modern-day slave labor practices, illegal deforestation, animal welfare violations, and major hygiene breaches. In 2017, its holding company agreed to pay one of the biggest fines in global corporate history, $3.2 billion, after admitting bribing hundreds of politicians, and yet JBS's products remain on supermarket shelves across the world.
Yeah. So, with regards to these allegations of bribery and their admitted bribery of thousands of public officials, the rural lobby in Brazil, of which JBS and like-minded firms are a big part of, is one of the strongest, most powerful lobbies across Brazil. And insofar as anyone is responsible for the rapid ascendance of Jair Bolsonaro, they have played a big part in that. I think that one thing to bear in mind is that this activity that they're engaged in is done far from the light of day insofar as media attention and public attention goes oftentimes. And so to the point, for example, about accusations of forced labor, one thing that we know is that Brazil, even in 2019, remains a country where forced labor is unfortunately remains the norm in many industries and a presence in many industries. And that, unfortunately, if we look, for example, at situations like the Venezuelan migration crisis, we now have tens of thousands of Venezuelans leaving Venezuela and seeking work. And oftentimes they're among the most vulnerable workers. And so these firms are able to do their work in very remote regions of the country, far from the public eye, oftentimes far from the media eye, and to the extent that there's any political interference, they have plenty of cash to offer politicians to give them the cover that they need. It's fundamentally anti-democratic insofar as when we look at polling data among Brazilians, as recently as August 12th of this month, one of Brazil's largest polling firms did research on showing perceptions of the Amazon among everyday Brazilians. 96% of Brazilians across the political spectrum in this poll believe that the government should be doing more to combat illegal deforestation. 88% of Brazilians in this poll believe that the Amazon is a source of national pride. And 93%, including Bolsonaro voters, find these trends of deforestation in the Amazon worrisome. And so we have the overwhelming majority of Brazilians against this sort of exploitation of the Amazon, and yet their president is enabling and empowering massive billion-dollar firms to continue this work unabated.
When we're talking about beef coming from Brazil, there is a graph from beef2live.com, in case anyone wants to see it. The United States has imported 1.57 billion pounds of beef just this year, up 3.2% from 2018. Brazil ranked the sixth largest beef exporter to the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got Canada, Australia, Mexico, New Zealand. I mean, the list is very, very long.
Yeah, and it's been huge business for Brazil, and it's been one of their most important exports, not just beef, but soybeans as well. And it's really happening, the trade conflicts that are happening across the world and largely spurred on by Trump's trade war have only fed the appetite for Brazilian exports of agricultural materials. And so while we have American farmers sitting on their hands and sort of holding a lot of agricultural products that might otherwise be shipped to China during this trade conflict between China and the United States, we have Brazilian farmers of both cattle, soybeans, and other agricultural products finding unprecedented and insatiable demand from China for Brazilian products. And so that's part of what spurred this rampant deforestation and land grab this year, unfortunately. And so these dynamics are really complicated. And fundamentally, though, it's also Brazil. What I think history will show is a strategic blunder on the part of Bolsonaro and his economic advisors, is this is continuing this trend of Brazil fundamentally being a source of raw materials and raw commodities for the rest of the world, rather than developing more dynamic industries within its own borders.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, when you think about how globalized the food system is now, how do you even begin to unravel that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd love to do a show about that. But to your point, CBS had a piece about how China, the world's largest soybean buyer, as you said, it stopped buying soybeans from American farmers. And so they were forced to look elsewhere for 30 to 40 million tons of seed. China imports 71 million tons of soybeans from Brazil, an amount equal to all Chinese soybean imports 5 years ago. So it's just going up.
Yeah, and a lot of that traffic will increasingly be river traffic along the Amazon River, river barges along the Amazon River.
And this is so China can feed its animals. And China bought Smithfield, which is the largest pork producer in the world. Mm-hmm. So there's just so many layers to this when you're talking about this globalized system, and then demand for meat is on the rise in many parts of the world.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing is for listeners to consider is what steps can they take in terms of thinking about where the products that they buy are in this supply chain. Another because as consumers begin to raise consciousness about this, there's an opportunity for firms potentially to change their behavior in ways to meet the demands of consumers for products. I don't think anybody would want to eat their burger knowing that they're contributing to or put on leather shoes knowing that they're contributing to deforestation in the Amazon.
Well, you can find these stories at yourcallradio.org. Chris Feliciano Arnold is a freelance journalist and author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. And you can find the interview we did with Chris about his book at yourcallradio.org. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.